This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us. On today's episode, we were in conversation with Adam the OT, marking Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month, and of course, taking your questions too. Using AI to find a job, some of the hacks you need to know, and some of the latest websites that can be truly beneficial for enhancing your life. Discussing the importance of being financially independent as a woman, why saving isn't enough, you need to be investing too. And Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist, was on hand. They've noticed a rise in eating disorders and disordered eating. Why is this? And what can you, as a parent, a friend, a loved one, do to support those around you? Adam Griffin is here, aka Adam the OT. He's the head of occupational therapy at Kamali Clinic and a really vocal advocate for disability, for inclusion here in the Middle East. Years of experience supporting young adults, disabilities, their families, and particularly interested in DCD, autism, and childhood and adolescent mental health. It's lovely to have you with us. Is it weird to say happy Occupational Therapy Month?
No, it's not weird at all. It was, for me, every month is Occupational Therapy Month. But thank you. I love the sentiment.
Why is it important to be having months, awareness months, that kind of highlight the work that you and your colleagues do, Adam?
Well, sometimes I think, I know I'm biased saying this, but I think OT is sometimes the unsung hero of learning support and child development, because a lot of my families, they come to see OT and it's not, I don't want to say it's not critical. It is vital. It can help a great deal, but it's not like the child is crying out for support sometimes. It can be subtle needs, things that are holding the child back from achieving their full potential. And families may not realize that support is there to actually really help this child develop the skills and develop the knowledge, develop the mindset and develop the character they need to really have the best life possible for them.
That must be really rewarding for you, because, and I said it earlier, and I didn't mean it lightly, just how life-changing it can be for a child routine, but also for their family as well. Where have you seen some particularly, I don't know, eye-watering transformations that made you think, gosh, what an amazing job I do?
Yeah, it's the lovely example about this job, as I have literally dozens and dozens of those stories. A lot of the time it'll start off, a family will come in, they'll get referred to OT for something that seems very small, almost trivial.
Like what?
For example, most common referral for OT worldwide anywhere is handwriting and pencil grips. So this is what they'll come in for. Then you realize that's the tip of the iceberg. And this child has motor coordination challenges. They're picked last for football, and that affects their confidence. They have sensory needs. They have attentional difficulties. Life just feels harder than maybe it has to be. Mm-hmm. And then as you start working, this is the important one, working with the child and with the family, yeah, we can show them that they can improve their handwriting and even make it fun. But also you're going to raise so many other things, and you're going to get this child to build up not only their skills and attitude, but also their belief in themselves as they move into life.
How do you get kids on side? And, you know, I love and adore you, but I would imagine for people like, oh, you know, it's another thing to do. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it's, you know, I'd rather be at home on my, you know, Switch. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
How do you, in that first meeting, win that kid over?
Yeah, these are my favorite kids, actually. So I had an example of this very recently. If they're listening, and they do listen, I think they might recognize themselves. So a child came in, arms crossed, like, who's this guy? I don't like him. He's going to try and make me work on things I don't want to work on. I'm not doing worksheets. Don't make me pick up that pencil. Who do you think you are? And he was going to, no way. I had no tricks. I was going to convince this guy. He knew all my moves.
How old was he?
Okay, bro. He would have been, I think, 7 or 8. Okay. And very switched on kid, really awesome. These are my favorite guys, because my whole brand of OT or therapy or child support, it's working with the child, not to the child. So I need their emotional buy-in. So I have my own little clarion call for all therapists, is go fun first. Adam's 3 rules. It's going to be fun, clear, and accessible.
Putting the fun and functional.
Oh, my goodness me. There you go.
Get that on a t-shirt.
Yeah, I'm doing you air high five across the studio. But this is why. Because whatever, I'll find out what they love. So if it's Fortnite or Minecraft or Marvel movies or anything else, and then I'm going to use that as a little bit of a springboard. I'm going to make the activities so undeniably fun and interesting that they're going to come with me. And then I'm going to go to where they are at their level of ability. It's going to be fun, clear, and accessible. Fun, obviously. clear, they'll understand what I'm asking them to do, and accessible, it's just challenging enough to make them develop those skills. Not boring, not kind of off-puttingly difficult, but then when I make it so fun, if I weigh the scales, if you imagine like a balancing scales, if I can put so much fun at this end of the scale, it doesn't matter how fearful, how anxious, how kind of uninterested they are over here, my level of fun is going to outweigh all of that stuff.
What about getting parents on side? Because sometimes this can be a challenge of, well, denial that there might be an issue or a diagnosis that needs to be addressed, maybe cost or time implications, and finding it quite hard to justify.
Yeah, there's a few parts to that. So I would answer that question differently if I was speaking to therapists and I was speaking to yourself or families. I'll tell you from the therapist side of things first, because this is when I was working with a relatively young therapist recently, and this is what I told them is they did... Child comes in for an assessment. They did all the standardized tests. They had all their scores and everything, but it was very clinical. It was very reductionistic. It's all correct, but this kind of, you're off from the outside looking in. But it seems like there's nothing wrong with that, but the family are external to the whole process. Mm-hmm. The very important thing is you get information and feedback and real life experiences from that family. So you're addressing the very things that matter most to them, the very things that are making their life more challenging. And then you're going to, that's where you start off from. And then it's a not, here's the report, here's my goals, give me the child for 6 months and I'll give them back to you. It's like a conversation. It's a constant dialogue. It's a dynamic experience working with families, at least it should be. And it needs that kind of back and forth. Families will always have questions because it can be, maybe Adam's, he looks like he's just playing. I am playing, but it's not just playing. So I want you to understand the rationale for everything I do.
Makes sense. Adam the OT is with us today, Adam Griffin. We are going to be going to the text line in just a few minutes. Mentioned there, the most common reason for children going to see an OT is handwriting. We've had anonymous message saying any exercises or activities that can help with it. It's an 8-year-old boy who gives up easily, doesn't have an official diagnosis, but definitely struggling. I've had a question about sensory processing. Joining us in studio to answer my questions, but most importantly yours, is a man whose calendar is pretty jam-packed. So the fact we've stolen him away from Kamali Clinic for an hour, I am incredibly grateful for. So brilliant chance to pick the brains of Adam Griffin, a.k.a. Adam the OT. We're just talking there, Adam, about how the most common reason for referrals to an occupational therapist is handwriting. But as you touched on, it's not just handwriting. That can be, you know, really something that might... alert parents, teachers to other things that are going on. We've had a message here from no name, you can be totally anonymous, on the text line saying, are there any exercises or activities to help with handwriting in an 8-year-old boy who gives up easily? No official diagnosis, but he's definitely struggling and school have flagged it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's tons of stuff you can do there. The only issue, I'd say, what makes it slightly hard to give a better answer to that question, there's a lot of things that can affect the child's handwriting. So it could be about their letter formation, their line placement, their hand strength, coordination, dexterity, the way they hold their pencil, a lot of these different things. But that in itself is actually one of the helpful things to consider is when I ask a child, okay, write something for me, and then I'll say, well, that's not very good, is it? I would never say that. But yeah, no.
I'm glad I'm not on Facebook. But my face was like, what?
This is kind of what they will, this is their internal monologue. Mm-hmm. They'll give me an example of writing and they're like, I hate writing. And then they'll write and say, I told you, look, it's terrible. And that's what they think. But then I'll show them, okay, because the main focus is on legibility. And if they write something like that, they are not really aware of all the 20 different things I've done wrong. If they give it to the teacher, make it red pen all over it back. So I'll focus on maybe one thing at a time. So getting the young person to be more aware of things like a very easy one to do at the beginning. It's called line discipline, about putting their letters squarely in the line. If you look, even Google something for very cheap, free, printable, highlighted paper. So it's got yellow lines on it and makes the child more aware. Remember Adam's three rules, fun, clear, accessible. This is clear. So they can see, this is what success looks like. This is what good writing looks like. And then they'll see the difference themselves. Like, well, that's really cool. I can do it.
Because the danger, I guess, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is, I'm rubbish at handwriting.
Well, it's partly that. It's partly the self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's also because if something's very hard and you don't know how to get better, your motivation's going to tank.
Totally.
And if you're not, I do this little thought experiment when I do a workshop of this about if you go to a yoga class and don't understand what everyone's doing,
yes,
and they're all like
been there
in Lululemon
horrendous
stuff, and
everyone's
they're all awesome.
Handstands.
Yeah. And they're like, what? I'm meant to do what now? So that's what the experience is like for some of my handwriting kids. But when they see, okay, I'm better at this now than I was last week, and then you can make other fun activities, even things like mazes and join the dots and puzzles and whatever else you can do. I have tons of these handwriting little activities. In fact, my Teachers Pay Teacher store, I have a whole bunch there. And that's ways to develop this skill, but in a fun way that doesn't feel like work, that the child can see their own progress.
Is it ever too late? Would you work with teens?
100%. At that point, you can think, okay, why do you need writing? So the whole Simon Sinek thing, that start with why. If you have a good enough why, you'll get there. Mm-hmm. So we realize, okay, it needs to be legible. I need to do writing that people can see, not to pass an exam. I don't care about that at this stage. Ultimately, I want the young person to ensure this difficulty doesn't hold them back from expressing their knowledge.
With the handwriting, how is that then integrated into the classroom? How is it communicated to a teacher? You know, what if the child's feeling a bit self-conscious? You know,
yeah, there's adaptations. In fact, my T-shirt even says adapt on it.
It says advocate, accept adapt.
And adapt. Yeah, I'm going to talk about this T-shirt in a second. But the adapt part, it doesn't mean you're lowering expectations. It doesn't mean you're trying to say, oh, no, he can't do it. Instead, you're just ensuring this single difficulty doesn't hold him back. For example, the kid's doing a history paper and loves the Roman Empire. Could talk your ears off about it. But if he has to write 4 pages on it, you're going to get the briefest of answers and not understand all this. What this kid knows when he's excited to tell you. If you have him verbally present it, maybe instead of 10 questions, you try and get the same understanding out of maybe 5 or 6 or 7 questions. So you're just reducing the volume to ensure this difficulty isn't an impediment while still developing the skill at the same time.
Makes sense. Rajiv saying, hi Helen, should we use tracing books to help and practice handwriting?
Interesting. Yes, but there's tracing books and there's tracing books. So there's some of the ones I like. You'll develop things like pencil control for sure. OTs weirdly don't love things like, you'll see letter formations which are like dot to dot.
Yes.
Better is doing something using the highlighter to draw the letter and then going over the top of it. So it's smooth. It's one fluid movement. You'll get tracing books that are like grayed lines and follow those as well. But yeah, no, anything that uses that pencil control, especially if you get tracing books or even doodle books that have like Minecraft or Fortnite or whatever they're into, then that's a great way to capture that motivation while they're building the skill.
You mentioned some resources that you have. Where can we point people if they want to find out a little bit more about handwriting in particular, Adam, and indeed download anything that might be useful?
Yeah, there's a few actually things I used for like literally years myself. Then I decided to put them online. They're a big old hit. And they're on my Teachers Pay Teachers store. So this is something like educators use all over. They're actually, just have a sale there. This genuinely wasn't prepared, but for Autism Awareness Month, then this is something I did. I think it's 60% off all my stuff. So I have 2 main like bundles. So that's 12 activities that's like 60% off at the minute.
If what people want to send me the word Adam to 4001, you can send me, we'll find the link during a bit of Duffy. Adam Griffin with us today. We've had questions about how to get a diagnosis. Adam mentioning there it is Autism Awareness Month. We're going to be returning to that conversation in various forms all the way through the next couple of weeks. As I said, we've had questions about sensory processing. Anonymous message here asking about Adam's take on dealing with rough ASD boys as they get older. Joining us live in the studio is the head of the Occupational Therapy Department at Kamali Clinic, Adam Griffin, aka Adam the OT, a really vocal advocate for inclusion. And you've even got the word on your T-shirt, Adam. Can you talk us through your T-shirt? Because I think it's a particularly pertinent time. It is Autism Awareness Month, but you've got advocate, accept, adapt on your T-shirt. Tell us why.
I do. There's a certain synergy about it, isn't it? This was actually sent to me by a lovely OT who makes like a therapy-related merch from the US. So thanks, Kim. She sent me this shirt. So it says, advocate, accept, adapt for autism awareness. And I had this conversation with someone recently that this month, so all of April, but specifically today is Autism Awareness Month and Autism Awareness Day. But a lot of the neurodiverse community, a lot of my friends who are autistic or would be kind of advocates like myself, I try to be for this community, they want to expand it beyond awareness, because this was true maybe like in the 90s and where you wanted to expand awareness because a lot of people hadn't heard of autism.
Yeah, so you had a lot of people, you know, living in, you know, well, fear of stigma for one thing.
Yeah, 100%.
Or just not knowing what their symptoms might be adding up to.
Exactly. Now it's much more kind of visible. But my goal and the goal of the ASD community is to expand beyond just awareness. We don't mean just people to be aware that autism exists, but also to have another one of these words, which is accept. So you can be aware of something, but then you also need to be accepting of it. Accepting of this, it's not something that's broken. The kind of metaphor I always use is like an operating system. So you have one brain's a PC and one brain is neurodiverse as a Mac. The Mac doesn't run PC software. It doesn't mean it's a broken PC. It means it's a Mac. It does different things in different ways, but can still be very successful at the same time. Mm. So that's the thing. It's different, lot less bright, not broken, to use the words of Temple Grandin.
Can I ask you about phrasing, terminology, labelling? Because I think a lot of people, myself included, get a bit nervous about that. What do we need to be aware of? And I guess what's the kind of most accepted or welcome descriptions?
This gets quite a heated conversation online, has done for quite a while. So one of the main things is about the terminology. Say if I was a young person, are they a young person with autism or are they an autistic young person? So is it person first or is diagnosis first? And it's kind of an intuitive response for a lot of the what we call neurotypical community. They would say, oh no, we want to see the person first. So it would have John has autism, not John is autistic. And that seems right. That's like an intuitive reaction. Like, that seems fair. But we have revealing insight from people within the neurodiverse community. And this is why it's important to listen to voices from the neurodiverse community, because they would say, no, it doesn't mean I'm less. It's not like I have a broken leg. It's like I'm green-eyed or like I'm got red hair or something like that. So they would say, no, I am autistic. So they have the autism right there, up in front and center, to raise and say, this is something I'm proud of. This is an aspect of who I am. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not something to be fixed or run away from or be scared of. It's just a part of who I am.
Adam, the OT, with us today. As you said, it is Autism Awareness Month, but let's add acceptance into the mix there. We've had a question about getting a diagnosis. This is from Bilal saying, our son is 7. We're pretty sure he's autistic. He's 3 years behind his peers in everything. He's in year 2, working at a much younger level. He doesn't sleep at night, very fussy eater, can't use cutlery, struggling socially. My question is, how do I get him a diagnosis? Is it done by the school or by a doctor? At school, there's a speech therapist, an occupational therapist, an educational therapist. Can these people diagnose autism?
Okay. What's the name of the person, sorry?
Bilal.
Bilal. Well, thank you very much for your message, Bilal, because I think a lot of families are in the similar position. So diagnosis, if you think of the rationale for a diagnosis in the first place, a lot of families can put this off because they're kind of fearful of the label. And sometimes that's a rational enough kind of worry and concern. But getting the right support and getting the right information will help you make informed decisions going forward. It'll help you identify the kind of supports that would help your child. Because for me, I don't care what the diagnosis is, honestly. It's the main things, the functional things that are holding this child back from achieving their full potential. What you want to do, Google is not always your friend when it comes to like autism and labels like that, because you get mixed polarizing information, not always the best information. If you go to a service like Kamali, obviously I work with Kamali, they're an excellent, like gold standard service, but there's many other in town as well. You want to go to the right professional, which in your case would be an educational psychologist is excellent, developmental pediatrician, child psychiatrist, any of these folks. And OT or speech and language therapist cannot diagnose autism. It has to be coming from the right person. And that's important because they need to do the gold standard of the specific test called an ADOS and an ADI. And those are the things. Sometimes you'll go into like a regular GP who might just look at your kid for 2 minutes and say, no, he doesn't have autism. That concerns me sometimes. And again, maybe well-meaning, it doesn't look like his perceived notion of what autism is, but it presents in lots of different ways. For example, a lot of girls misdiagnose entirely because people think, oh, girls don't have autism. Oh, yes, they do. It can really affect their quality of life. So getting the right people and having the right information can help you make an informed decision. And just that's all it does. You go, if you have a broken leg, having an x-ray and seeing where the break is helps the treatment process from then on. Doesn't affect the fact that your leg was already broken. It won't change the child you have. They're still a little Timmy. You'll love them exactly the same, but will just help you make decisions and support your child going forward.
Such good advice. Bilal, I hope that helps. Got anonymous message we're going to be coming to next. Wanting Adam's take on dealing with quote-unquote rough ASD boys as they get older. Our son is 8, getting so tall and strong. I'm worried about how my wife and his nanny will cope as he gets bigger. We've been talking autism acceptance, handwriting hacks and more with Adam Griffin this afternoon. Adam, the OT, the head of occupational therapy at Kamali Clinic. And as soon as I read this text to you off air, you were like, yeah, I want to talk about that. This is from an anonymous listener saying, I'm curious to hear Adam's take on dealing with what this gentleman saying, rough ASD boys as they get older. Our son is 8, nearly 9, and getting so tall and strong that I'm worried about how my wife and his nanny will cope with them as he gets bigger. Is this something you hear from parents?
Yeah, this is a really common one. So I see this kind of throughout the lifespan, throughout the kind of growth of the child, because it highlights an important point that if you have a young person, say with autism or with sensory needs, they don't grow out of it, they tend to grow into it. And depending on the more support they get and depending on what you do, they can grow into it really successfully. But if there's not addressed, if you don't have a solution to that, you can kind of just try your best to get through the day and be kind of blindsided of these difficulties making your life more challenging. A lot of my families who have this presentation will actually avoid the very things that would actually help. They'll avoid sports because he plays too hard and hurts for the kids. They'll avoid birthday parties because maybe the bit of rough and tumble goes a little too far unintentionally and it's just a bit stressful. So it's very, very understandable to circle the wagons and kind of make your world smaller. But no, what you do, what helps in a great deal, a lot of the time kids on the spectrum will have a need to move. They have this sensory seeking need specifically for, not to get too technical, but for a thing called proprioceptive sensory feedback, which is heavy, muscular, effortful work. That's why a lot of my kids like rough and tumble play. They like the swings, the pulling, the kind of physical play, the rough and tumble stuff. If they come into See Us Guys and Gracie Baja, Silicon Oasis, and Jiu-Jitsu, then they'll really get a lot out of that rough and tumble aspect of martial arts as well. When a child is younger, that can be like, oh, look, he needs to move. Let's get him wobble cushion. That need to move doesn't go away, and as a child gets bigger and their bones and muscles get bigger and stronger too, it's not so cute and easy to ignore anymore, and the child's growing into their sensory needs. I use a metaphor of their nutritional diet to their sensory diet. So he's constantly hungry for this proprioceptive sensory input. The trick is twofold: keeping his sensory tummy filled up, giving him lots of rich, intense, proprioceptive, heavy work sensory input to reduce his impulse to seek it in other ways, but at the same time, increasing his kind of social awareness and understanding of this is not appropriate in this context. It's okay to do here. This is where we can use our muscles and go hard and go strong and you really, really go effortful. But then when we're working with families, we have to be a little bit more careful because they don't like to play as hard as we do. And that's something you'll work. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. You're going to learn a little bit every time. But those two things will help a great, great deal.
Adam, I wanted to ask you as a parent of two neurotypical children about inclusion socially, about having birthday parties, play dates with a child that might, you know, be on the autism spectrum. Sure. And I guess, yeah, just trying to be as inclusive as possible. What can be really helpful to parents and to those kids?
Yeah, well, kids are naturally curious in the best way possible. Sometimes kids will actually pick up the apprehension and anxiety from parents because parents are actually worried about doing the wrong thing. If you see like little kids in kindergarten, they're not at all worried about doing the wrong thing ever. They'll just stumble through things. You kind of want to keep a little bit of that kind of younger kid curiosity and just open their eyes like, oh, this is why anything that's avoided because it's awkward isn't always going to breed kind of a little anxiety and suspicion and kind of that idea of other and difference, where it's more if the child, for example, if one of my kids is stimming in the classroom, so self-stimulating behavior, very commonly seen with kids in the spectrum or with sensory-seeking kids, and it can look unusual, but that helps that kid. So I don't want to stop it, even though it looks atypical, but I will help the other kids understand this is why little Johnny is doing that behavior. It helps him. And then that they understand where he's coming from, see his perspective, and then it's a little bit easier. They can invite and include the child without putting additional pressure on them. And the more it's just exposed to the difference, the more acceptance tends to breed.
Makes sense. Thank you so much for your insights today and every time you're in the studio, Adam. For anyone that wants to find you, you are there at Kamali Clinic. What about online? Because your Instagram, your YouTube, brilliant resources for play, as you said, putting the fun in functional. What's the best way of finding you online?
Yeah, it's definitely through Instagram. So AdamTheOT on Instagram. The thing I talked about, the little activity bundles, they're actually on my link in my bio as well. I just remembered.
Easy.
But find me on Instagram. Message me directly because I get messages from parents every day and I really do love getting them. So please do. I know it can be scary having the diagnosis or worrying about your child's thing of learning and development and being someone the parents can come to. I really take pride in that. So feel free to message me about anything.
Thank you so much. We'll make it even easier. If you want to send me the word Adam to 4001, I will send you the link so you can indeed reach out, find out more. Maybe we weren't able to get to your question today, or maybe have been feeling a bit shy, haven't had the chance to pick up the phone. Adam the OT, or send me Adam to 4001. Joining us in studio is a woman who describes herself as an AI optimist, which I have to say might be a bit of a lonely gig right now because a lot of concerns out there. But we're putting your mind at ease, especially when it comes to identifying jobs, applying for jobs, what HR and hiring managers are doing with AI so you can get around the back of that. Holly joined in studio since she is the CEO and founder of Digital Fluency and the co-founder of Woman for Tech. Holly, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very happy to be here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I am so interested in, well, we're going to talk about the AI optimist piece in a minute, but I guess what is your mission, especially with women in tech? What's your kind of goal with that?
Well, one of the things that I've observed is that the tech industry doesn't feel very inclusive. It feels like people who aren't in tech don't have a voice in it, can't access it. So what we want to do with Women for Tech is bring women who are not in tech into the conversation around tech and give them a voice around creating a positive future enabled by technology.
So this is women from all sorts of different backgrounds, disciplines, trainings.
Absolutely. So whether you're a doctor or a journalist or an accountant or a lawyer, you have a voice in what that future looks like because AI technology is going to pervade all our lives. And so we all need to understand what it's doing and have a point of view about how we want that future to look.
I think there's a real danger and quite an understandable one is to go, I don't want to think about that. That's something for other people to be concerned about. I don't see how that applies to my life. And then unfortunately, that knowledge gap just gets bigger and bigger. And then you do find yourself falling behind. But it's a very conscious choice to tune into that conversation, to put yourself in that conversation and take an active interest in learning about it. What other misconceptions do you feel like are out there right now around AI, Holly?
Oh, a huge number. Where to start on that? So I think, first of all, people don't understand that AI is not just some big machine sitting in Silicon Valley. AI is actually an umbrella term for lots of different technologies. And we should actually be talking about AI in the plural rather than the singular. I think people think that AI is somehow very objective and always logical, but of course, AI is only as good as the data that it's trained on. Mm-hmm. AI makes mistakes. We talk about hallucinations with AI. And when it comes to decision making, of course, when we make decisions, they're not purely logical. As human beings, we have intuition. And that plays a hugely important part in the way that we make decisions.
What about this worry that it's going to take over the world and replace us all? How realistic do you think that is?
Well, of course, AI will take over different tasks. And I think it's really important to remember at the moment that AI is narrow in terms of what it can do. It can do certain tasks. But the idea that someone can come along and wave a magic AI wand in an organization and it's suddenly going to replace the jobs, it is not realistic. If you think about an organization, you need to have really clear procedures, really specific job descriptions for an AI to come and take over what you're doing. Mm-hmm. The reality is that we should be thinking about AI in terms of augmenting and supporting our jobs rather than replacing them.
So as a tool rather than a replacement. Now, Absolutely. You do describe yourself as an AI optimist. Why is that?
Well, I think technology in and of itself is neither good nor bad. It's something that is neutral. It just is. And AI is all about how we use that technology and how we deploy it. So I'm very optimistic about what the technology can bring the world in terms of access to education, access to healthcare, in terms of economic inclusion. But also I'm very cautious because, and that's why I've started Women for Tech, because I want people to have a voice in a broader number of people to be involved in that conversation, because at the moment it's a very small group of people, mostly on the west coast of California, mostly male, who are talking about what that future looks like. But I'm optimistic if we get involved now, we can change that narrative.
Holly joined us in the studio, CEO and founder of Digital Fluency and the co-founder, just been talking there about Women for Tech. Up next, using AI, how does Holly use it day to day, but specifically for identifying job opportunities, applying for jobs, how do you use AI? And what do you do with the time you save? Are you more productive, or do you give yourself a bit of a breather? Demystifying AI now with Holly Joint, the CEO and founder of Digital Fluency and the co-founder of Women for Tech. She's on a mission for AI in particular to feel more inclusive, to give people who aren't necessarily working in that specific sector a voice, the education to understand how it can benefit us. She describes herself as an AI optimist. And I wanted to ask you, how do you use AI on a daily or weekly basis, Holly? And I guess I'm really trying to pick your brains in terms of how the rest of us could be integrating it too.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't have a very specific structure. I use AI as a companion, someone to brainstorm with. So often I'll be saying, give me 25 different ways of phrasing this, and 24 of them will be rubbish and one might be quite good. Mm-hmm. I will ask for ideas around LinkedIn articles. I don't use AI to write for me because I enjoy the process of writing. It helps me think. I get AI to create images for me. I use AI to record meetings and voice notes and turn that into transcripts.
Oh, how? Which platform are you using for that?
Well, there's one called Otter AI that can record your calls, and also a real time saver. I don't know if you find that you're totally overwhelmed by all the emails you get from school
constantly.
Something that you can do with Gmail with their tool Gemini is ask it to summarize all your emails from a particular sender in Gmail and pull out the most important points. That's a massive time saver.
Oh my goodness, mine would be like zero important points. It was relevant to a school class that's not your child's. So that's in Gmail. That's Gemini.
That's Gemini. It's outside Gmail, but you can ask it. You can link it to your Gmail.
Wow. We're talking about jobs in particular today, and I wanted to ask you about how can AI help you identify job opportunities, whether that is giving you ideas and suggestions for what your next step might be, but also to establish what is available in the marketplace. Are there any applications there?
There are lots of different tools out there. I would generally just use the standard kind of base tools like ChatGPT or Gemini that are available. I think you can use these tools as coaches and mentors to help you think through what your skill sets are. You can get them to look at your CV and pull out important points. And then in terms of actually applying for roles.
Yeah, the dreaded cover letter.
The dreaded cover letter.
The worst. I hate a cover letter. But how do you then strike the balance between having something that is going to be ticking the boxes? Because let's be honest, HR and hiring managers are using AI as well now to whittle down hundreds, if not thousands, of candidates. So being able to tick those boxes in terms of, you know, keywords, identifying skills, matching what's in the job description, between coming across like a human?
Well, the first thing is to use AI as a support, a companion, a tool, and not to replace your own thinking. So the first thing I would do is get that job description and put it in the tool and ask it to pull out certain keywords that are important. And then you can ask it to look at your CV and help amplify your CV in terms of what kind of words you need to be including in there. There are tools out there that will do that for you, that will create your CV for you from scratch. But I'd just be really conscious of making sure that you're checking through everything that AI is producing.
Yeah, because that's the interesting point in terms of, well, certainly ChatGPT in terms of dates. You know, it's not completely up to date. I asked it just because this is about 6 months ago, just out of curiosity, because I do some freelance writing. And I was like, oh, that would be interesting to see how it would write, you know, a 500 word article about family friendly Dubai. And it was like, oh, you can't miss skiing at Dubai Mall. And I was like, ha ha ha, it's Mall of the Emirates, dummy. So yeah, don't take anything for granted factually, because Well, nobody's perfect. Yeah. What kind of conversation do you think we'll be having in 5 years' time, Holly, about the real life applications for AI for us norms who aren't, you know, necessarily working at the cutting edge of tech?
Well, I think what we're going to see is multimodal AI, which is AI that is integrating text, images, video, and that's all coming together.
Some of the video coming out now is absolutely stunning. I think, you know, from animation point of view, we're seeing studios not investing so much in a studio space and looking at, you know, tech inside that. So that kind of creative industry, I think, is very interesting. Well, same with writers as well. You're never going to get an AI, you know, writing a script that, you know, from start to finish, but having something on the page for someone to work from to edit can be hugely beneficial. It can ask you as a parent as well. You know, if we're looking a decade in the future, what do you think we should be encouraging our kids to lean into to future-proof their careers?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I was talking to my niece the other day and she's really interested in becoming a florist. And I was saying, well, that's probably quite AI proof because actually people aren't going to invest the money in robotics for floristry. I think at the moment, we don't know what the future is going to look like. No one has a crystal ball. But the important thing is for us to be making sure that our kids have really good critical thinking skills and that they also understand the importance of human interaction and that they understand the difference between a human and a machine, mm-hmm. and that they're giving instructions to a machine.
Can I ask you lastly, women for tech, what does that look like in practice? If there's any women listening today who say, do you know what, I do want to lean in this conversation, I want to educate myself, I want to be part of that conversation. What does it look like in practice and how can people get involved, Holly?
So we're in the very early days at the moment, but what we're bringing to women is an opportunity to enhance their skills. We're bringing mentoring, thought leadership. We're also reaching out to corporates and offering services to corporates because it's equally really important. And we're looking for support from corporates to help us on this journey.
We had a question here from Sala saying, what's her favourite AI tool? Oh, that's a good question to end on. So what's your kind of go-to or you feel like, do you know, more people should know about this?
Well, I'm just testing a tool at the moment called Cleft, which is able to take my rambling voice notes when I'm on a walk and structure that into something sensible. It's only in beta testing at the moment, so there are quite a few glitches, but actually I think that's going to be something that's really useful for me.
Thank you so, so much, Holly. For anyone that wants to reach out to you, find out more about digital fluency or Women for Tech, what's the best way of getting in touch?
So I'm very active on LinkedIn. So I've got an unusual name. I'm fairly easy to find, Holly Joint. Women for Tech, you can find us as womenfortech-UAE, or you can drop us an email at info@women4tech.ae.
We'll make it even easier if you want to send me tech or AI on the text line 4001. I can send you those links so you can find out more. Thank you so much for your time today. Really, really interesting and so much more to talk about. We have run out of time for today, but as I said, if you want more information, send me tech, send me AI. I'll understand what you mean on 4001. Thank you, Holly.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
It is time for some real talk. Our next guest says every marriage will either end in death or divorce. Be financially prepared for either. We're talking about the importance of being financially independent now with Lydia Andrews. She's a wealth advisor, a coach from Love Yourself Financially. I've never thought about it like that, but you're absolutely right.
Yep.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really well. I love talking money. I think I'm quite new to the conversation. I've only started investing in the last kind of year and a half, and I'm kind of a bit annoyed and a bit embarrassed that I didn't take control of that for a very long time. There's probably more pairs of shoes in my wardrobe than there would have been had I started on that journey earlier. So I'm so glad that you're just as passionate. What is your mission, Lydia? What's your goal?
I want to see all women investing and building wealth and doing so by healing their relationship with money.
This is what I wanted to ask you. So your course has three parts. You look at money healing, money mindset, and money moves. What do you mean by money healing and why is that such an important foundation for, I guess, well, repair, obviously, but reaping the benefits?
Because I think the foundation of building wealth starts with healing, and that means looking at your mindsets, looking at any money trauma you may have experienced, the way you respond to money. So in different financial situations, when you get a bill, when you're at the grocery store, anything, If your emotions are a bit out of whack, then it tells me you need to heal your relationship with money.
What can cause a money trauma? Can you give us some examples of, you know, things that people might have gone through that can inform their philosophy around money as an adult?
Sure. It could be something as subtle as hearing your parents argue about money growing up, hearing them make certain statements like money doesn't grow on trees, put that back, we don't have enough money for it, it's not worth it, you know, it's too expensive. These type of comments impact the way that you view money.
Can I ask you then about your philosophy, which is about put yourself first? And we're talking about women in particular. What are some of the stories women tell themselves about money, their potential to earn, to invest, that stops them from putting themselves first?
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't understand. It's too late for me. There's so many. And unfortunately, we've been socialized to think that maybe we have to depend on someone else. Mm-hmm. Our husband's going to do it. Our parents did it for us. So We don't need to figure it out. And that's a lie.
It is. I mean, my dad, to this day, if he could fill out my, you know, bank forms and do everything for me, he would. Because that was his way of caring, mm-hmm. of being protective and showing love. And it was very easy to go along into like my 20s being like, oh, Big Dave will help me out. And mm-hmm. then, as you say, you can get married and allow someone else. How important is it for women to have a seat at the table when it comes to knowing what family finances are? And even if they're not earning themselves, but to understand what money is where and what it's doing?
Honestly, I don't think I can state it strongly enough, because I've seen too many circumstances where women have no idea what's going on. Either they get divorced or their spouse dies, passes away, and they're shocked by some of the revelations that come through. Mm-hmm. So it's important for women to be aware of what's going on from the very beginning. A lot of times women are very much involved in the household expenses, but not involved in the investment decisions. And I think it's probably more important to be involved in the investment decisions.
That's quite a hard thing to kind of turn in towards after you've been married for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, suddenly be like, right, let's sit down and talk about, you know, let's get the bills out, let's get the accounts out. Because as you say, in an ideal world, it would be from the beginning that, you know, we're equal partners in terms of our understanding, our ability to be a team, to move forward together with the same financial goals. But to then come in and say, well, I listened to Lydia and Helen on the radio and now I want to be involved. What about getting that financial education so you feel like, you know, more empowered to be part of that conversation? Where does that come from?
Well, that's what I'm here for. So I have something called Money Dates. It's very simple. You and your spouse, your partner can sit down and you don't have to delve deep into your finances initially, but you're having those conversations, understanding your values behind money, why you spend the way you do, why saving is important. And then when you get to the heart of it, then you can start opening up a bit more as you become more vulnerable and you share. Then you can touch on those important topics such as investing and planning.
What if you've got very different philosophies around money? Mm-hmm. Someone's a saver, someone's a spender, someone maybe doesn't want to reveal the debts or loans that they have, even to the person that they're closest to. That must be really difficult to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they say opposites attract, right? So it's only natural to expect it. But it's not about judging the other person. It's about understanding where they're coming from. Because the way that we spend money, the way we manage money now, is a reflection of our upbringing. So if I can understand where you're coming from, I'm going to be a bit more gracious with you. Mm-hmm. And I'll be willing to have those conversations. But unfortunately, because I don't understand, because we haven't had those conversations, I'm just going to attack you. I'm going to judge you. And I'm going to say, point my finger at you and we're going to have arguments, which we don't want.
Joining us in studio, Lydia Andrews. She's a wealth advisor, a coach from Love Yourself Financially. Going to come to a couple of issues next. Pink tax, gender pay gap. And Lydia saying saving money isn't enough. You've got to invest. But where do you start? That's coming up.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
In conversation now with Lydia Andrews, she says every woman should be financially independent, regardless of their relationship status. According to data, 59% of widows and divorcees wish they'd been more involved in long-term financial decisions. I've got so many questions for you. And I guess I wanted to come to that point there about getting married. You know, what are some of the questions you should ask yourself, the conversations you're having with your partner before you walk down the aisle?
There are so many, but one of the important ones is how do you manage the money? The joint account conversation. Personally, I believe you should have separate accounts and you can have a joint account for expenses for investments that are done jointly. And even for that, both people should have to sign before anyone can access the money, not just one person.
What about the gender pay gap? In terms of, there's not a huge amount of transparency in certain parts of the world, but it is very much still an issue. And pink tax, do you feel like women are disadvantaged? Is it harder for us to earn more and save more and crucially invest more?
This is exactly why women do need to invest, because unfortunately, the world is set up such that we're earning less money and then we have to pay more money due to the pink tax.
For anyone that's not familiar with what pink tax is, would you explain it?
Of course. So the pink tax is very simple. If you look at our products like shampoo, razors, men's products are generally blue. Women's products are pink. Women's products cost more. There's no reason for it.
Gypped again. Mm-hmm. So the odds are not in our favor in terms of incomings and outgoings, but do you feel like investment is where you can tip the scales?
Exactly. You know, compound interest will work in your favor, and use the money that you have to invest so that you can build wealth. Because unfortunately, women are more likely to save than to invest. And I really want to see women investing.
How do men and women invest differently?
Mm-hmm. I think men, generally, if you look at the research, are much more risk takers, but women are not. And because of that, women end up being more successful when it comes to investing.
Because this is something that I've kind of had a realization with over the last couple of years, which is investing is actually really boring. Mm-hmm. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm. I agree. A lot of people should be investing very simply in the stock market.
Mm-hmm. For beginners, mm-hmm. are there any books, any resources, whether it's your own or someone else's? Mm-hmm. Because people could be listening to this going, okay, I understand I should be investing, but I don't even know how to access a platform, what I should be looking for, how much of my salary should be going into certain, in certain pots. Mm-hmm. Can we do a real kind of 101 guide? I know it's something that you address in your course as well, but for people listening today, we can get them on the right path. Where to start?
Well, the first thing is you need to know how much money is coming in and how much money is going out. Then you know your disposable income number. From your disposable income number, then you can decide how much you should allocate towards investing for the future. You need to have an emergency fund, so at least money that will survive, that you can survive on for about 6 months minimum, ideally. Then you can save towards sinking funds, so any short-term expenses, vacations, and so on. Then you can look at investing for the future. So you need to know, based on your own balance sheet, how much you can put towards the future.
You mentioned money dates before. This is something that you have on your website, your Instagram. Would you mind kind of sharing the best way of getting in touch with you, Lydia?
Sure. My Instagram, I'm on all social media as Lydia Elim, LYDIAELIM. You can DM me. You can click the link in my bio. I have my free download there for money date night.
Tell you what, if you want to send me the word money, we'll make it even easier. So you have a 14-week course where you work with a cohort of women, take them all the way through these three stages. So money healing, money mindset, and money moves. Would you mind kind of breaking those down for us and why they are really crucial, kind of in the order as well?
Mm-hmm. So before, we talked about beliefs, mindsets, money trauma that all make up your money story. And it's important to heal from that, because that money story impacts the way that you manage your money today. And if you don't heal that, you might be managing your money in a way that does not allow you to live and thrive financially. Mm-hmm. So when you do heal that, then we can shift towards money mindset. A lot of people focus on money mindset, and I do think it's important, but unless you truly work on the healing first, your mindset, you can work on it for a bit, but you might revert eventually.
Do you feel like some people, and we're talking about women in particular, but some people might have beliefs that they're never meant to be wealthy, they don't deserve to have money?
Oh, absolutely. I hear those statements all the time. And sometimes now I can hear it very subtly. And without even realizing, for example, a phrase like saying that person is filthy rich. Money isn't filthy. Why are we saying things like that?
But isn't that interesting that I feel like there is a certain amount, I'm talking as a woman, mm-hmm. to feel a bit of guilt from doing well or investing well. There's some really interesting data about what women choose to invest in, whether that is more ethical or feminist stocks, because you feel like, okay, I'm supporting a business that I believe in, and a nice byproduct is that I'm getting a good return as well.
Yeah.
Interesting messages coming in. One here saying, invest more in the stocks of designer brands rather than just their bags. LVMH and Hermes have great returns. It's really interesting. A message here saying, great show as always. My husband and I met in 2020. He's entertainment. I was in education. Then COVID hit, both out of work. It took 10 months to secure a job in a different sector. Lost my home, spent my savings, not my confidence, as I've always been financially independent. I was a sole breadwinner for 2 years and it's been a struggle. We are experts at being poor. Decided to take a risk and go back to a career in real estate. No basic salary, no husband at work. Some months are steak dinners and some are super noodles. My husband's now working and I'm doing well in a job I love. We made it. We share all bills, never argue about money as we struggled for so, so long. We're looking forward to a honeymoon this year as neither of us have left the UAE since 2019. That's wow. Well
congratulations.
Done. Congratulations. Because yeah. I think there can be this idea of feeling defeated, mm-hmm. of like, well, this is it. Now we need to leave, or we need to, you know, this is how it's always going to be. Yeah. It's a real choice to educate yourself, to mm-hmm. connect with people. A message here saying, when is the next course? And loads of people asking for your details mm-hmm. as well, Lydia. So sure. It's not until after the summer, but in the meantime, you do have some great resources. Can you kind of explain a little bit about how you work with people?
Sure. I mean, I do some one-on-one coaching as well. My coaching cohort doesn't start until September, but in the meantime, feel free to get in touch with me. My money dates, I am in the process of creating a bunch of new resources, so they should be out by the end of this month, so stay tuned. Join my email list. You'll have updates. I send weekly newsletters every Friday.
Ooh, yes. I'm on it.
So there's some good stuff there.
What is your number one tip for women in particular who feel like their head is in the sand and they are out of their depth when it comes to finances?
Take one step. If it's just send me a DM and that's the one step, if it's watch a video and that's the one step, take one step. That one step will boost your confidence and then you'll take the next step.
Build that momentum.
Exactly.
And start investing. Mm-hmm. Thank you so, so much, Lee. I really, really enjoyed talking to you. I think it's wonderful to think about people being proactive. And, you know, we think about this kind of idea of glass ceiling. It's not always a glass ceiling. Sometimes it's a door that you need to hold open to the people behind you. And I think
exactly.
you're doing a wonderful, wonderful job of that. As I said, lots of people sending me the word money to 4001. With your permission, I'll share your details so people
sure.
can reach out there.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You might see me in September.
Oh, I love that.
If you want those details, you can get in touch. You don't need to put your name on it. No questions asked. We would just love to help you out and get you on that road. We've got the real thing now. You to me are everything on Dubai i103. 3.8. We do talk money matters every single Tuesday afternoon. I guess I feel like I should offer something of a trigger warning. We're having a bit of a deep dive into eating disorders and disordered eating over the course of this next hour. On hand is Dr. Thoraya, clinical psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Now, eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of any mental illness. And yet, they're often misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed because of stereotypes and stigmas encountered by patients. So if you've got any questions, you want to share your story, you want clarification or you need some specific advice, please, please, please do not hesitate to get in touch. We really are here to support. Dr. Thoraya joining us live. How are you, Dr. T?
I'm well, Helen. How are you?
I'm well. I've already had a number of messages on this topic, which doesn't surprise me because you wanted to talk about this because you're seeing an increase of cases coming in to clinic. Would you mind telling us a little bit about when you started noticing this and maybe anything we can point to in terms of trends or data that might indicate that eating disorders are actually on the rise?
Well, actually, it's been really interesting because from the work that we've noticed, we have a lot of individuals that experience disordered eating. So before I get into eating disorders, but just having not a great relationship with food overall. But what we've noticed in general with the research is that the statistics in the region have actually been increasing more and more year by year. And, you know, even in the UAE in 2023, imagine this is last year, there's a prevalence of the risk of eating disorders in children and adolescents up to about 16 years old to be approximately 23.4%.
Wow.
That is a staggering number. You're talking about almost a quarter of the population of children and adolescents up to 16 have a higher risk of eating disorders. And it's not just that, but we're seeing, you know, even binge eating disorders up to about 17% in the UAE alone. In places like Egypt, you have 65% of females, whereas 30% of Saudi Arabian females as well. I mean, the numbers are just, you know, they're increasing and increasing mm-hmm. with time, which is quite interesting. And of course, with a lot of disordered eating or even eating disorders, we have a lot of comorbidity, which is a lot of other disorders that seem to accompany them, like anxiety disorder, depressive disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, those kinds of things, and even some personality disorders.
And this isn't just the Middle East. You know, numbers out of the UK suggesting that 1 in 5 older teenage girls have an eating disorder. That's according to NHS figures. that were rightly called devastating by campaigners. We've seen hospital admissions for eating disorders risen by more than 50% since the first lockdown during COVID in the UK, and the greatest surge being amongst young children. Really, really worrying. So this is children under the age of 10 have seen the biggest proportional increase, with tripling in hospital admissions. We can talk about treatment, and we will be talking strategies and how to broach the subject with someone in your life that you are worried about. But I guess my first question is, Dr. Thryer, why? You know, why are we seeing more cases? Are we seeing more awareness and more people reaching out for help?
It's a little bit of a lot of things, to be honest. It's not just that there's more awareness and people are reaching out, but I think we are seeing an increase in difficulties with disordered eating or eating disorders due to the increase of fake social media pictures, these models or the trendy kind of being healthy and fit and having the six pack and all of these things. And so people are really worrying so much about their caloric intake and they're kind of taking it to a different extreme. But also when we talk about disordered eating or eating disorders, we really have to talk about the root of the cause. And a lot of that comes from control difficulties. And that's either because people have been either making fun of them as they were growing up because being bullied because of their weight, or family members trying to control them as individuals, or even controlling their eating. There's a lot of obviously trauma and abuse in childhood that contributes significantly to eating disorders and disordered eating. There's also a heavy focus on achievement and perfectionism in the household that also contributes significantly to eating disordered and disorders and disordered eating. And so there's so many different factors that have been contributing that not only people have become more aware, but I think the influence of social media has exacerbated that percentage and the prevalence that we're seeing nowadays.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we think about social media. I mean, it's very much kind of two tracks you need to acknowledge. One is, yes, this force for negative influence, for, you know, the filters and the stretching and the, you know, photoshopping. And there's also, and I have to say, you know, credit to some social media platforms, a real crackdown on, so for example, pro-anorexia groups, you know, removing certain hashtags. But on the flip side, you know, social media can be an incredible resource for support and, you know, and getting help and I guess kind of finding your tribe as you start to move out of that. We've had a message asking about the difference between eating disorders and disordered eating, which I think is a really important thing to establish. Would you mind kind of expanding on that for us, Thryer?
Sure. So the difference between the two, when we say disordered eating, it's basically having some form of negative relationship with food in general. And that could be that, you know, you tend to emotionally eat, for instance, or you tend to even sometimes like restrict yourself or go through severe caloric counting. However, when we talk about eating disorder, and remember, like the reason why we say like psychologically and psychiatrically, when we talk about an eating disorder, it's because it creates a disruption in the order of your life. So it's actually affecting many areas of your life. When we're talking about disordered eating, it's that it's not a healthy relationship with food. However, it may not necessarily be causing an extreme disruption in the order of many different areas of your life. So that's how we differentiate between the two.
Dr. Thryer with us today had a message saying, is the usage of medications like Ozempic leading to disordered eating? Really interesting thing about other influences out there as well. Joining us live on the line from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic is Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist. She's seen a rise in eating disorders and disordered eating coming through the clinic, and certainly the data worldwide reflects this too. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how eating disorders affect individuals beyond physical health. You know, what are some of the common misconceptions about these conditions, Thryer?
Well, it's tricky because when you want to discuss that, you have to discuss each one separately. Mm-hmm. So for instance, for anorexia, there's actually a term that we use psychologically, which is called the anorexic brain. which is a brain that is so different from everybody else. It's a brain that's extremely rigid. It's a brain that is completely disconnected from reality. It's a brain that sees what it wants to see, but it's also a brain that's very manipulative internally. So it's not, and very deceptive externally, because usually with anorexia nervosa, the brain is so scared and it's so it has so much malnutrition that it no longer functions the way a natural and healthy brain is supposed to. So it actually is, it's unfortunately one of the worst prognosis for us when it comes to eating disorders, because of the amount of malnutrition that exists in the brain. With something like bulimia, for instance, there's a lot of difficulty with emotional regulation. There's a lot of difficulty with the brain kind of working to regulate itself to create that balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. With binge eating disorder, it's also very similar to that, because it's quite tied to the enteric nervous system. I mean, if you look at what the enteric nervous system is, it's the gut brain, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, the gut actually produces about 90% of our serotonin and half of our dopamine. So both of which are powerful neurotransmitters that affect mood, that help the mind stay calm and focused. And they're actually natural antidepressants. So that bidirectional communication between the brain and the gut microbiome is extremely important for our mood. So these different eating disorders significantly influence not just our mood, but our health and our tendency to view food in a way that's important for our health.
And I think that's why a lot of friends and family members can find it so frustrating to have mm-hmm. someone in their life that, you know, does have a diagnosed eating disorder. You know, I said earlier, you know, such an incredibly high mortality rate, especially anorexia. And I had a girl that used to work with me a few years ago who passed away last year from anorexia, and it just hadn't even crossed my mind that she would. I know that sounds so strange, but we'd spent so long trying to get through to her. She'd been, you know, long, long stays in hospital, all the love and support that, you know, we thought was around her, and it just wasn't enough, because, as you said, the we couldn't get through to her. You know, we've had messages in the past from people saying that they've had, you know, sisters and friends, and just talking about how selfish they are when they're living with an eating disorder. It's all they can focus on, and subjecting their family to some really, really difficult times, which, you know, must be very hard for families to deal with, to separate, because it's not just affecting one person, it's affecting often a whole family.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think this is one of the most difficult things, and it's a crucial part of the therapeutic interventions, is not to just work with the individual themselves, but also to work with the family, to get them to understand that person's brain is not, especially with anorexia, that person's brain is not functioning through logic at all. It's just on constant fear mode. Mm-hmm. And everything that we see when we're looking at a person or talking to a person who has anorexia, they're seeing something completely different. Their reality is very distorted. And at the same time, the amount of fear that they possess internally makes them reject everything that we're saying, and almost they feel paranoid to what we're saying to them, almost like we're trying to trick them into something. So when you look at a person and you call them either selfish, or they're, you know, they're this or they're that, that's really not the case, because who they are is not their sickness. The sickness is kind of like taking over, and it's taking control. And that's actually the irony behind a lot of these eating disorders, is that in hope for that person to gain more control of their life, they're actually losing more of control of their life.
Try lots of questions for you. We've had messages asking, you know, is veganism for a 14-year-old girl resulting in poor protein and nutrition considered an eating disorder? We've had questions about the use of medications like Ozempic. Also an interesting point here about when you can get diagnosed with an eating disorder, saying, you know, my daughter's been diagnosed at 28. You know, is this too late? Plus, V's been in touch saying, my soon-to-be 13-year-old daughter has been referred to a specialist. Her appointment's on Thursday. I'm trying to think of questions I should ask at this appointment. Your help and support are very much appreciated. We We are seeing a global increase in the number of eating disorders. In the UK, hospital admissions have risen by more than 50% since the first pandemic lockdown, and the greatest surge seen amongst young children. We've also seen more men being affected too. To guide us through the whys, the hows, treatment and more, Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. A really interesting point actually come in on 4001 for you, Dr. Thryer, saying, is the use of medications like Ozempic leading to disordered eating? Have you seen anything or heard anything along those lines?
To be 100% honest, I don't think I'm qualified to kind of answer that question. But what I do know about Ozempic is that a lot of individuals are using it as a quick way to lose weight. And what we're finding is with this usage, it can increase the risk of disordered eating later, and maybe an eating disorder later, because unless the person understands that they need to really change their lifestyle, using Ozempic or Mounjaro is not going to really give them the desired effect that they want. So it's kind of like, you know, doing the balloon or a gastric bypass and really not changing your lifestyle, right? So it's quite similar to that. That intensive weight loss could lead to disordered eating if the person doesn't understand that their whole life is going to change after using this.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I don't mind saying I used Mounjaro about a year and a half ago for a couple of months and lost, you know, I think actually probably a bit too much weight on it. And it was under doctor supervision. I didn't just go to the pharmacy and, you know, hand over the money. But what I found, and I'm very happy to say this, I love the supermarket. I love a stroll around the supermarket and having a list and then buying something that catches my eye and feeling a bit inspired about what to eat. I was walking around the supermarket with absolutely no interest. Nothing took my fancy, nothing at all. And that was a massive red flag for me because it started to feel bit like medicalized anorexia. And I was like, no, this is not actually useful psychologically or long-term healthy, I don't think. But I mean, everyone has a very personal experience. For some people, they, you know, feel terrible on it. Some people get awful side effects. For some people, you know, it's been a really useful tool. As you rightfully say, if you think of it as a tool and a way that you are going to have to adjust your mindset around food, the way you eat, and really examine the psychology around it rather than just restrictive eating. But that was my experience. I was like, no, I want to go into Spinneys and fancy buying some barbecue chicken thighs. Like that's a pleasure in my life. I don't think this is working for me. We've had a message here saying, and again, I don't know if you're the right person to ask this to, but I want to raise it because I know this listener's on air now, saying, is veganism for a 14-year-old girl resulting in poor protein and nutrients considered an eating disorder? So that's it, but it raises an interesting point in terms of labeling certain food preferences, or I don't want to call veganism a trend, but you know what I mean,
right,
as a way of restricting under a different label.
Right. I wouldn't necessarily say veganism is an eating disorder unless it's accompanied with quite a few other characteristics and qualifications. However, any type of diet, be it veganism or otherwise, any type of diet that is used in an unhealthy manner, especially when there is malnutrition or there is a significant health effect on the body, yet the person is continually using that diet, that can definitely contribute significantly to an eating disorder. But it is not an eating disorder in and of itself.
Dr. Thryer, are you ever cured of an eating disorder, or is it something that's always going to be there in the background?
So it's an interesting question. Unfortunately, what we do know is that at least with in moderate, severe or extreme anorexia, usually it's kind of always in the background and a person has to be very careful. It's almost kind of like an addiction that a person has to admit to themselves that this is something they have to continuously worry about. When we catch it quite early and it's still very mild, we can really help reverse the effects that it has on the brain. With bulimia nervosa, with binge eating, it is something that it has a better prognosis, I would say, than anorexia.
I wanted to ask you, and we're going to talk about therapy, medication, support groups after the traffic, but I wanted to ask you first, Thuraya, what advice would you give to someone listening now who suspects that they or a loved one might have an eating disorder, but they're unsure how to seek help, they're unsure how to broach that conversation without pushing them away, maybe encouraging more secretive behaviour?
So I would say if you are the person that is experiencing either disordered eating or an eating disorder, please get help, because the quicker you work through it, the better the prognosis is. And I say please because out of all of the disorders that I have ever worked with as a psychologist, the eating disorder, especially anorexia, is really difficult. And the more that a person is in it, especially a woman who experiences amenorrhea, which is losing your period for quite some time, it's just so sad to see the trajectory of a person's life and a shortened life, to be honest. I mean, so if you are the type of person who's experiencing it, please seek help, professional help. Don't go to anyone that is not competent or qualified to take care of this. So we're talking about a psychologist or a psychiatrist and nothing else than that. If you're a loved one of a person who's experiencing an eating disorder, it also depends on which eating disorder, because usually, let's say with anorexia nervosa, this would be a different way of approaching it, because you don't want to talk about the person's weight. You definitely don't want to say you're too thin, because you're actually encouraging them to do it more, right? So you want to move away from what they look like and talk more about their health, and at the same time recognize that you are not going to be able to handle this alone, because with anorexia, you need a full team. And usually more often than not, individuals with anorexia or severe and extreme bulimia tend to be hospitalized because of how severe it becomes. So I would say, no matter who you are, and be careful how you approach the topic. And if you don't know how to, then please contact a professional to help you do that in a way that's not going to hurt the individual, or even worse, encourage them to engage in that behavior.
Thuraya with us through until 5 o'clock today. Thank you so much for your insight so far. We are going to talk the role of therapy, medication, support groups in that recovery process as well. And we've had a message from V saying her soon-to-be 13-year-old daughter has an appointment with a specialist on Thursday. What are some of the questions they should be asking? Having a look at disordered eating here in the region, but also internationally as well, numbers on the rise, especially in younger children, teens as well. Dr. Thuraya, I wonder if this is a bit controversial. Do you think anyone has a truly healthy, neutral relationship with food? Because I'm running through my mental Rolodex of pretty much everyone I know, and I'm like, we've all got our hang-ups and our issues to some extent.
Well, I mean, I would agree with you, to be honest, in certain cases. So, you know, food in general for us is usually associated with either a social environment, love from the house, or even something negative that we associate with our childhood. So the difficulty in dealing with or having a positive relationship with food is because not only socially do we hear so much about food. I mean, people comment about either your weight, the way that you look, or like what you're eating on a consistent basis. So we're over flooded with stimulus that has to do with our food content and what we eat and what we don't eat and things like that, that sometimes it just takes over. And because, I mean, in general, the idea of food, we can't remove food from our existence like we could with, you know, if we're addicted to something, like a substance or something like that. We need food to survive. So that trying to find that balance and moderation between eating the things that we want to eat and eating the things that we need to eat for ourselves, you know. So I think that balance a lot of us struggle with because of the overstimulation that we have with what's right, what's not right, what's in the research, what's not in the research. And every year there's something new that you're supposed to eat or not supposed to eat.
Yeah, and you look at the Daily Fail and you're like, coffee's amazing, coffee's terrible, you know, tomato, all the rest of it. It's really hard to you know, quiet the mind and quiet the headlines. I just want to end with a message that we had from V saying, hi, both. Thank you so much for this. My soon to be 13-year-old daughter has been referred to an eating order specialist and her first appointment is on Thursday. She eats small amounts but exercises excessively and won't eat anything with sugar in it. She also drinks lots of water to fill herself up. I'm trying to think of questions I should ask at the appointment. Your help and support are very much appreciated. So would you mind maybe suggesting a few things that V and her daughter, or his daughter, can be raising with this expert on Thursday in their first appointment?
Well, the first thing that I would say is, what does the expert suggest in terms of treatment? Because some individuals will jump quickly to one treatment or another, such as either medication or pure psychotherapy that has to do with cognitive behavioral therapy. And I am not a, I'm really not a big fan of doing one thing. This, especially when it comes to eating disorders, this has to be a multidisciplinary situation. So you need to look at nutrition counseling. You need to look at the possibility of medication, but maybe not always medication. You have to look at family therapy. Family therapy is extremely important as well. And it's not just about focusing on the symptoms that cognitive behavioral therapy does, but it's really looking at the background of where this started, how it's developed, the underlying causes of this behavior. So what I would, the first question I would ask is basically, what are the treatment options that the expert is suggesting? And is it holistic in nature? And if it isn't holistic in nature, then I would reach out to a different expert, to be honest. If you would like also, because I know that we're almost out of time, Helen, so if you'd like, you can contact me directly on Instagram and I can give you a list of other questions that you can ask. But this would be the most important one to
Thank
start
you.
With.
Thank you. Really, really valuable. Thurai, I really appreciate your time. If anyone does want Dr. Thurai's details, there, Human Relations Institute and Clinic, you just send me the word doc and I will send you her Instagram, which is fantastic, regardless of the topic. Thank you, Thurai. I really, really appreciate it and see you very soon indeed. And thank you. We had a number of questions asking about specific cases in terms of weights and ages and different medications. I would suggest obviously going to your trusted family doctor with that. So please, please, please do reach out to someone. If you need a recommendation, you can just send me a message. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.